You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Rebecca Hackman. She's talking to me from Manhattan, Kansas. Rebecca, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for inviting me, Brainerd.
So, Rebecca, before we talk about your work, I feel like I have to ask about Manhattan, Kansas. You know, is there other than in name, is there any relationship at all to Manhattan, New York?
Apparently, well, I'm here because I got a tenure track teaching position, and I got lots of time to make my art and travel money, so I decided to move from New York to here. The relationship historically, I believe, is that a boat broke down that was full of New Yorkers, and they had to repair the boat, and then they liked it here so much they decided to stay and found a land-grant university and a town, and they just named it Manhattan. But I think that that might be sort of accurate. And it's actually the Little Apple. So it's cute. It's a university town. So it's about 70,000 people, I believe. And I like it for a while.
And what are you working on now? What are you busy doing there? I mean, I know you're teaching, and we could perhaps talk about that or your PhD, but are there any projects that you're working on?
Yes. Well, I wouldn't mind dispelling a couple of myths, if you don't mind. You know, when I was in New York, I always thought if you taught that you couldn't do what you, the real thing, you know, then you would teach. But actually, to get a teaching job, you have to already be a well-known artist. And I teach photography and photography history a little bit and theory. And we teach 2 days. And then the rest of the time we have to do our art and exhibit it internationally and nationally. I'm at the moment finishing a PhD that I started 8 years ago at Chelsea College of Art in London. And its focus is public art in New York. For which I had to do a big public art project as well. And the project consisted of these telephones, or they look like telephones, but they're not really telephones. And they are called the public autoraton machines. I installed them in areas where you don't normally see public art in New York. I found in my research that most public art in New York is, or most sort of object-based public art, not social practice, is sort of in the tourist areas predominantly. A lot of the public art agencies install art inside schools if it's in the Bronx or further out. And so I decided to do this project that intervenes into a space where you don't normally find it. And I placed these public autoraton machines on sidewalks in Brooklyn and Greenpoint and further out, and the viewer or the whoever's walking past can pick up the earpiece. They look like 19th century phones, so the speaking part and the earpiece are separated.
Almost looks like not a phone booth, but a little bit like a phone booth, right? It's attached to a pole and it's near the street, so it looks like it can almost be dialed, right? Okay.
Yeah, so people sort of know that it's a phone, but they know it's not a normal phone, and then they sort of assume it might be art because they don't know what else it might be. but they know that they have to pick up the earpiece. And when they pick up the earpiece, it asks them, there's a recording that plays, and it asks them questions about other public art. They are able to look into two eye holes. And inside there is an image by Def Koons, the split rocker that was on display not long before I installed them at Rockefeller Center. And but it asks them about that piece, if they know what it is, if they've seen it, and then it asks them who should pay for public art and where it should be installed and what it is, and it asks them just their opinions. And it records those responses. And so they're on the website, these responses, and they're about I think 10 questions. And then in addition, there's a little survey on the phone with a tiny little screen with yes-no questions. So the earpiece asks them questions where they can narrate and just talk freely. And the other questions are more direct and quantitative questions, yes-no. And it just says, do you go to community meetings? Would you like to see more public art in your neighborhood? Do you live in New York? Things like that. There are other things I had to ask, like are you over 18 and things like that. And then it asks who should pay for it, you know. All the results are being archived in the local libraries near where the public automatons were installed. And at the moment, I'm trying to find more funding to install more of them in above Central Park, in Harlem, in the Bronx, really areas where you really don't see quite as much public art. And so I'm back in sort of fundraising stage.
So that's exciting. I want to talk about that too, because so these Utterton, is that what it's called? The Utterton? How did you say that?
Yes, or Utterton.
Utterton.
Yeah.
And so they're gathering all this information. They're interactive. It's almost kind of like a talking telephone, right? Where you're getting all this data from people and interacting, and it has this other layer of being about public art itself. Mm-hmm. So before we talk about some of maybe the data coming out of there, how are these funded so far? Is it a public art program or Creative Time, or do you do this on your own? How do you get them out there and mounted? Because that's pretty exciting just to get work, you know, interacting with a New York landscape.
Right. Yes, and this is my second public art piece in New York. It's a combination of different sources. Both my projects that I've done in New York were fiscally sponsored by the New York Foundation for the Arts, and it's an international program, not just for New York residents, that allows you to fundraise under the umbrella of a 501c3. And so you're able to, you can, if you want, tap into foundation money as an individual artist. And I encourage people to go to their website, and they've got all sorts of tutorials and things like that on there. And you have to apply, so it's peer-reviewed, and they choose the project, which is unique to the way they do it. There are other places where you can get fiscal sponsorship where anybody can do it. I was able to do a combination of crowdsourcing on their sister. They have a relationship with Rocket Hub. So I was able to get some funding for it there. Then the other source of funding was my research university, Kansas State University, which is a land-grant Research 1 university. That means that you get to do 50% your own art-making activity and 50% teaching. My department at the time was very supportive of the project and funded a huge bulk of it. And then I got some money from the university where I was doing my PhD, and that was mostly travel money for me to go and also conduct interviews with people and have meetings. And
then there was permission to install it itself.
So that was by the New York City Parks and Rec Department, and they actually don't give you any money, but they curate work, and you can apply to have your work in public space in one of the areas that they own or manage. And they do own all the interstitial triangle spaces. They're called triangle parks in New York, and they're all over New York, and they happen when a diagonal street intersects with the grid. And then there are these little triangles, and they've made parks out of them. And I purposely wanted to use these interstitial spaces for art, because they're not traditional areas where you normally see art.
So that was directly with the Parks Department then, which is interesting. I mean, that's, of course, how Creative Time and the Public Art Fund also work, but you're working with them directly, and they work with artists directly,
yeah,
to, in a sense, give
and
you...
They do.
And it's permission for a temporary sculpture?
So,
is that how it's framed?
So in New York, temporary means under 1 year. If it's up longer than a year, then it becomes officially permanent, and you have to go through the design commission. It's a more extensive process. But one of my pieces was up for a year, a previous piece, the Urban Fields Glass project. And this piece was, these were up for months each. But yeah, any artists can propose a project with them. They don't really fund you directly, but they do help you get permits, and they work with the Department of Transportation to get the permission. My other project was funded by the New York City Department of Transportation, and I got, I think it was $2,600 or so. And then I also got a grant from Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, but that was a long time ago when I was still living there for part of the money for my other project. This particular project was more crowdsourcing and university funding, which is something that you have access to when you are in a permanent position at a research university. They have internal funding for projects and art materials and all sorts of things, travel funds.
But it also seems that this particular project, after it's funded and installed, it also has to withstand the elements, the construction of it, the building of it has to be somewhat durable. And in your case, that's, I would think that's somewhat complex because it's you have power in there and recordings and all kinds of things.
Yes. So one of the things about public art is you spend years planning it, and you have to have architectural drawings, and you have to show to the sometimes you need a certificate from an architect to certify that it won't fall apart, you know, things like that. And you have to have liability insurance. And so there's lots of administrative work that you don't normally do as an artist, and a lot of artists shy away from that. It's, I don't find it that difficult, but it's mentally draining, and it's 90% administrative work. And, of course, you have to have a good idea as well. But in my case, it was a solar panel, and I worked with my now ex-husband, and we didn't break up because of the project, but he was a programmer, and he was able to donate his time to do the programming, and we were able to have a solar panel power the recording, and this e-ink display, which is a very low-powered display using ink, and it doesn't use as much power as an LCD screen or a cell phone screen, and it doesn't look expensive either. And so it was self-sufficient in that sense because it was solar-powered. Somebody did steal the solar panel on the first week, and we had to go back and put a new one on. And, you know, there were things like that that happened with public art. But it was really interesting because the recordings are sort of now on the website. It's utteraton.com. It's UTTERATON.com. And what surprised me about results was that a lot of people didn't know what the split rocker was. They said, is that a dog? What's that thing over there? And a lot of people didn't know very much about public art or what it was, and some people did, and they wanted more. So that was really interesting just to hear from residents, you know, because the city earns a lot of money from public art, and it's always installed in tourist-heavy areas most of the time.
Well, what's also fascinating about that, and it's interesting that, you know, we're talking about how the whole thing gets produced and the people you talk to and the grants you get, because there's that whole process, which is, you know, typically behind the scenes process, right? We don't see the artists fundraising and writing proposals and architectural drawings. But also the data that you're collecting from this is almost like a collaboration with all these organizations, because there's immediate feedback that's beneficial to the organizations that are funding this, including the ones that are just giving permission, like the city, right? It's we're hearing from the actual people on the street who are interacting with this how their experience is.
That's a really interesting thing that you say that, because I really am not sure if the city is looking at this data. And that's sort of my next step after this huge, long PhD is to perhaps disseminate the fact that there is data and the data itself in a different system than the art world, because that's something, it's a different, it's just a different field. The art, public art administration is its own field. And I think it would be great if city officials looked at the data. And I'd like to.
But as it relates to your PhD, which you recently completed, you said that kind of quickly. So how is your PhD or your thesis also on that information in particular that you were gathering, or those types of information?
Yes, so in PhD you study the context of the field in which you're working. So there's a literature review where you look at where is the field of public art now, and specifically in New York, and where do I notice a gap? And then you intervene into that gap that you observe and that you describe with new knowledge, and the new knowledge is the nature of your artistic intervention, but also your analysis of the data, and also the conceptual statement you're making with the artwork. So the act of intervening on a pavement is artistically a very purposeful thing to do, and it's sort of a making a point as well as an artist by intervening into that space of New York there. and then you in the thesis you do describe the artwork, because it's a practice-based PhD, a studio art PhD, which doesn't exist in the States yet. And you describe your artwork.
It's a studio art. You said it's a studio art PhD, right, which doesn't exist in the States. We have research.
There are some programs, but it's not recognized as the terminal degree yet in the States. And but you do the artwork, but you describe it in a thesis with images, but then you also analyze the data, and then you suggest further research and talk about what you think needs to happen in the field for it to progress. So it's this complete cycle in a way where everything sort of fits together. The PhD in the United States is a contentious issue. I've been yelled at conferences when I've presented about it. And there are about 10 programs that have started PhD. UC San Diego's got one, Texas Tech. IDSVA has one, but they aren't a practice-based program. There are about 10 programs, and there's a lot of discussion about it becoming the terminal degree. In other countries, it has been the terminal degree for 20 years, and that includes the UK. And I think that it enables you to disseminate your work differently and better and get more access to funding. So I've really enjoyed it, but it's also been torturous at times. So,
I'm sure.
It's like having children. You love them, but at the same time, there's a loss, and there's this double-edged sword, but it's just life, you know. But it's been an interesting journey, and I definitely find normal administrative tasks much, much easier now, like planning public art projects, changed my life in many ways. But it's a big debate in the States.
And for the foreseeable future, what's next for you? I know the public sculpture, you're saying the Arutan could be in Harlem and other places. So you're going to continue to find places for that and fundraise. And is that basically what will be happening next for you?
I'm usually working on two or three bodies of work at the same time. I usually take a 3-year break between major public art projects, and so it's been 2 years, and I'm thinking about trying to fundraise or just installing in different places. I was nominated for a couple of grants that are really, really big, like 50,000 or so. And so I'm hoping that maybe I'll get one of those, and then I would be able to proceed, you know, with expanding this project. I also make studio work, you know, that consists of objects that I put in the gallery. I work with optical media, like projections in photography and stereoscopic imagery. And so I'm always working on those all the time. And I'm also writing a book about artists who use 3D and stereoscopic photography in their work conceptually, not as a gimmick. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
Well, that sounds interesting. We could certainly talk more just about the book. That sounds fascinating. Well, perhaps we'll have a talk again. Artists using 3D and stereoscopic photographic technique. That does seem like there wouldn't be that many, because you're talking about artists who really explore that as a medium.
Yeah, and I've used stereoscopic 3D in my work for many years in my photography work. There actually, I have a list of many artists who use stereoscopic 3D. Zoe Beloff, I don't know if you remember her, she made stereoscopic film. She was in the Whitney Biennial in the late 90s. And there are historically quite a few artists who used stereo, like Marcel Duchamp and William Kentridge made a series of prints that were stereoscopic. They were printmaking prints. And he's done installations that use stereo. And there's a Swiss artist who recently passed away. His name's Alphonse Schilling. And in the 70s, he built stereoscopic viewing machines that he wore on rooftops in New York and in Arizona. and there's quite a few of them that just haven't really been recognized as much as perhaps they should have. There is an artist at Microscope Gallery called Joel Schlemowitz, and he's created stereoscopic film strips on 16mm film that you look at through a stereoscope, and it moves, but you see these images in there in 3D that are historical images. And so there's quite a few, and it's a little, what would you call it? A book of artists' work, you know. Mm. And
when will that come out? When will that book come out, do you think? Or
oh, probably in about 2 years. It's slated to be published by Intellect Publishers, and it's basically whenever I get it done, which, you know, now that I finished my PhD, I'm really looking forward to starting other projects and reading what I like and not having to stick to one particular topic all the time.
Right. Well, that sounds exciting, an exciting book to read and perhaps talk about in the future. Before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading now, whether it's one or more books, whatever titles you have. I'd love to hear.
Well, I haven't done any leisure reading for about 8 years. On my nightstand, I have Frederick Jameson's The Cultural Turn, Selected Writings on the Postmodern, 1983 to 1998, by radical thinkers. But I'm always reading about four books at once, and I also have The Suburbanization of New York, The Ethics of Sightseeing, 3D Cinema and Beyond, and The Disciplinary Frame on my nightstand. And I, depending on my mood, I pick up a different thing, and then I also read The New Yorker and National Geographic and other magazines, things like that, whenever I have time. Okay.
Well, I'm excited about you finishing the rest of the work you have to do, and also hopefully having more installations in New York. That's all very exciting. Rebecca, I want to thank you for
talking
with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I love your series, and I actually often listen to the podcast. I just find them really inspiring to listen to all the artists, so I'm a big fan.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.